and he whispered, "Isn't that true, Father?" But the Father presence within spoke warningly, "Don't invite disaster. You're learning stroboscopic awareness now. Without it, you could overrun yourself, lose your place, mark, and time." And the bas-relief imagery persisted. Intrusions hammered at him. Past, present, now. There was no true separation. He knew he had to flow with this thing, but the flowing terrified him. How could he return to any recognizable place? Yet he felt himself being forced to cease every effort of resistance. He could not grasp his new universe in motionless, labeled bits. No bit would stand still. Things could not be forever ordered and formulated. He had to find the rhythm of change and see between the changes to the changing itself. Without knowing where it began, he found himself moving within a gigantic moment bienheureux, able to see the past and the future, present and past, the now in both past and future. It was the accumulation of centuries experienced between one heartbeat and the next. Leto's awareness floated free, no objective psyche to compensate for consciousness, no barriers. Namri's provisional future remained lightly in his memory, but it shared awareness with many futures, and in this shattering awareness, all of his past, every inner life, became his own. With the help of the greatest within him, he dominated. They were his. He thought, "When you study an object from a distance, only its principle may be seen." He had achieved the distance, and he could see his own life now. The multi-past and its memories were his burden, his joy, and his necessity. But the worm trip had added another dimension, and his father no longer stood guard within him, because the need no longer existed. Leto saw through the distances clearly, past and present, and the past presented him with an ultimate ancestor, one who was called Harum, and without whom the distant future would not be. These clear distances provided new principles, new dimensions of sharing. Whichever life he now chose, he'd live it out in an autonomous sphere of mass experience, a trail of lives so convoluted that no single lifetime could count the generations of it. Aroused, this mass experience held the power to subdue his selfdom. It could make itself felt upon an individual, a nation, a society, or an entire civilization. That, of course, was why Gurney had been taught to fear him, why Namri's knife waited. They could not be allowed to see this power within him. No one could ever see it in its fullness, not even Ganima. Presently, Leto sat up, saw that only Namri remained, watching. In an old voice, Leto said, "There's no single set of limits for all men. Universal prescience is an empty myth. Only the most powerful local currents of time may be foretold. But in an infinite universe, local can be so gigantic that your mind shrinks from it." Namri shook his head, not understanding. "Where's Gurney?" Leto asked.
"He left, lest he have to watch me slay you."
"Will you slay me, Namri?" It was almost a plea to have the man do it. Namri took his hand from his knife.
"Since you ask me to do it, I will not. If you were indifferent, though..."
"The malady of indifference is what destroys many things," Leto said. He nodded to himself. "Yes, even civilizations die of it. It's as though that were the price demanded for achieving new levels of complexity or consciousness." He looked up at Namri. "So they told you to look for indifference in me?" And he saw Namri was more than a killer. Namri was devious.
"As a sign of unbridled power," Namri said.
But it was a lie. "Indifferent power, yes." Leto sat up, sighed deeply. "There was no moral grandeur to my father's life, Namri, only a local trap which he built for himself."
"O Paul, thou Muad'Dib, Mahdi of all men, thy breath exhaled, sent forth the hurricane."
Songs of Muad'Dib.
"Never," Ganima said. "I'd kill him on our wedding night."
She spoke with a barbed stubbornness which thus far had resisted all blandishments. Alia and her advisers had been at it half the night, keeping the royal quarters in a state of unrest, sending out for new advisers, for food and drink. The entire temple and its adjoining keep seethed with the frustrations of unmade decisions. Ganima sat composedly on a green floater chair in her own quarters, a large room with rough tan walls to simulate siege rock. The ceiling, however, was imbar crystal, which flickered with blue light, and the floor was black tile. The furnishings were sparse, a small writing table, 5 floater chairs, and a narrow cot set into an alcove, Fremen fashion. Ganima wore a robe of yellow mourning.
You are not a free person who can settle every aspect of her own life, Alia said for perhaps the 100th time. The little fool must come to realize this sooner or later. She must approve the betrothal to Faradin. She must. Let her kill him later, but the betrothal requires open acknowledgement by the Fremen affianced. He killed my brother, Ghanima said, holding to the single note which sustained her. Everyone knows this. Fremen would spit at the mention of my name were I to consent to this betrothal. And that is one of the reasons why you must consent, Alia thought. She said, His mother did it. He hath banished her for it. What more do you want of him? His blood, Ghanima said. He's a Carino. He hath denounced his own mother, Alia protested. And why should you worry about the Fremen rabble? They'll accept whatever we tell them to accept. Ghani, the peace of the Empire demands that I will not consent, Ghanima said. You cannot announce the betrothal without me. Irulan, entering the room as Ghanima spoke, glanced inquiringly at Alia and the two female advisers who stood dejectedly beside her. Irulan saw Alia throw up her arms in disgust and drop into a chair facing Ghanima. You speak to her, Irulan, Alia said. Irulan pulled a floater into place, sat down beside Alia. You're a Carino, Irulan, Ghanima said. Don't press your luck with me. Ghanima got up, crossed to her cot, and sat on it cross-legged, glaring back at the women. Irulan, she saw, had dressed in a black abba to match Alia's, the hood thrown back to reveal her golden hair. It was morning hair, under the yellow glow of the floating globes which illuminated the room. Irulan glanced at Alia, stood up, and crossed to stand facing Ghanima. Ghani, I'd kill him myself if that were the way to solve matters. And Faradin's my own blood, as you so kindly emphasized. But you have duties far higher than your commitment to Fremen. That doesn't sound any better coming from you than it does from my precious aunt, Ghanima said. The blood of a brother cannot be washed off. That's more than some little Fremen aphorism. Irulan pressed her lips together. Then, Faradin holds your grandmother captive. He holds Duncan, and if we don't, I'm not satisfied with your stories of how all this happened, Ghanima said, peering past Irulan at Alia. Once Duncan died, rather than let enemies take my father. Perhaps this new Gola flesh is no longer the same as Duncan was charged with protecting your grandmother's life, Alia said, whirling in her chair. I'm confident he chose the only way to do that. And she thought, Duncan, Duncan, you weren't supposed to do it this way. Ghanima, reading the overtones of contrivance in Alia's voice, stared across at her aunt. You're lying, O womb of heaven. I've heard about your fight with my grandmother. What is it you fear to tell us about her and your precious Duncan? You've heard it all, Alia said, but she felt a stab of fear at this bald accusation and what it implied. Fatigue had made her careless, she realized. She arose, said, Everything I know, you know. Turning to Irulan, You work on her. She must be made to— Ghanima interrupted with a coarse Fremen expletive, which came shockingly from the immature lips. Into the quick silence, she said, You think me just a mere child, that you have years in which to work on me, that eventually I'll accept. Think again, O heavenly regent. You know better than anyone the years I have within me. I'll listen to them, not to you. Alia barely suppressed an angry retort, stared hard at Ghanima. Abomination? Who was this child? A new fear of Ghanima began to rise in Alia. Had she accepted her own compromise with the lives which came to her pre-born? Alia said, There's time yet for you to see reason. There may be time yet for me to see Faradin's blood spurt around my knife, Ghanima said. Depend on it. If I'm ever left alone with him, one of us will surely die. You think you loved your brother more than I? Irulan demanded. You play a fool's game. I was mother to him as I was to you. You never knew him, Ghanima said. All of you, except at times my beloved aunt, persist in thinking us children. You're the fools. Alia knows. Look at her run away from— I run from nothing, Alia said. But she turned her back on Irulan and Ghanima, and stared at the two Amazons who were pretending not to hear this argument. They'd obviously given up on Ghanima. Perhaps they sympathized with her. Angrily, Alia sent them from the room. Relief was obvious on their faces as they obeyed. You run, Ghanima persisted. I've chosen a way of life which suits me, Alia said, turning back to stare at Ghanima sitting cross-legged on the cot. Was it possible she'd made that terrible inner compromise?
Alia tried to see the signs of it in Ghanima, but was unable to read a single betrayal. Alia wondered then, "Has she seen it in me? But how could she?" "You fear to be the window for a multitude," Ghanima accused. "But we're the pre-born, and we know. You'll be their window, conscious or unconscious. You cannot deny them." And she thought, "Yes, I know you, abomination. And perhaps I'll go as you have gone. But for now I can only pity you and despise you." Silence hung between Ghanima and Alia, an almost palpable thing which alerted the Bene Gesserit training in Irulan. She glanced from one to the other, then, "Why are you so quiet suddenly?" "I've just had a thought which requires considerable reflection," Alia said. "Reflect at your leisure, dear aunt," Ghanima sneered. Alia, putting down fatigue-inflamed anger, said, "Enough for now. Leave her to think. Perhaps she'll come to her senses." Irulan arose, said, "It's almost dawn, anyway. Ghani, before we go, would you care to hear the latest message from Faradin?" "I would not," Ghanima said. "And hereafter, cease calling me by that ridiculous diminutive, Ghani. It merely supports the mistaken assumption that I'm a child. You can—" "Why'd you and Alia grow so suddenly quiet?" Irulan asked, reverting to her previous question, but casting it now in a delicate mode of voice. Ghanima threw her head back and laughed her. "Irulan, you try voice on me?" "What?" Irulan was taken aback. "You'd teach your grandmother to suck eggs," Ghanima said. "I'd what?" "The fact that I remember the expression, and you've never even heard it before, should give you pause," Ghanima said. "It was an old expression of scorn when you Bene Gesserit were young. But if that doesn't chasten you, ask yourself what your royal parents could have been thinking of when they named you Irulan. Or is it Ruinal?" In spite of her training, Irulan flushed. "You're trying to goad me, Ghanima. And you tried to use voice on me. On me? I remember the first human efforts in that direction. I remember then, ruinous Irulan. Now get out of here, all of you." But Alia was intrigued now, caught by an inner suggestion which sloughed her fatigue aside. She said, "Perhaps I've a suggestion which could change your mind, Ghani." "Still, Ghani?" A brittle laugh escaped Ghanima. Then, "Reflect but a moment. If I desire to kill Faradin, I need but fall in with your plans. I presume you've thought of that. Beware of Ghani in a tractable mood. You see, I'm being utterly candid with you." "That's what I hoped," Alia said. "The blood of a brother cannot be washed away," Ghanima said. "I'll not go before my Fremen loved ones a traitor to that. Never to forgive, never to forget. Isn't that our catechism? I warn you here, and I'll say it publicly, you cannot betroth me to Faradin. Who, knowing me, would believe it? Faradin himself could not believe it. Fremen, hearing of such a betrothal, would laugh into their sleeves and say, 'See, she lures him into a trap.' I understand that," Alia said, moving to Irulan's side. Irulan, she noted, was standing in shocked silence, aware already of where this conversation was headed. "And so I would be luring him into a trap," Ghanima said. "If that's what you want, I'll agree, but he may not fall. If you wish this false betrothal as the empty coin with which to buy back my grandmother and your precious Duncan, so be it. But it's on your head. Buy them back. Faradin, though, is mine. Him I'll kill." Irulan whirled to face Alia before she could speak.